weeknights from 6
on 2FM.
Well, a big thanks to the two Johnnies in Africa for the afternoon entertainment. It is Monday, April 15th, and you're listening to Game On with me, Shane Dawson, alongside Ruby Walsh. Coming up between now and 7pm, Tony O'Donoghue is standing by with the latest on the FAI fallout, and CEO Jonathan Hill is set to depart at the end of the month.
Staying on the topic of soccer, Alan Colley and Stephen Kelly are with us to reflect on the latest twists and turns in the Premier League title race, while Keane Chasey trats rugby as Ireland record a win over Wales in the Women's Six Nations. Leo Cullen's Leinster outfit outwitted Ron Nagara's La Rochelle, and there is the possibility of some big breaking news in Leinster as well, Shane.
Breaking news has just broken, Ruby Walsh. We will get to that in a few moments. We'll also be chatting to Peter Canavan on Gaelic football, and Ruby will have his say on Irish glory in the Grand National. As always, if you want to have your say, you can text us on 51552, WhatsApp 087-187-9200, or we're on X at Game On 2FM.
Game On 2FM.
So, Ruby, you alluded to breaking news, and then I looked up at my screen and I saw a press release come in from Leinster. As you were speaking, it doesn't get...
It was flashing up from a news organisation on my screen, Shane, so I was hoping they were right, so I'm glad Leinster Rugby have told you. And that news, Keane Tracy, is...
Jordy Barrett has signed for Leinster from December. That's the All Black sensation, you would have to say. One of the best players in the world is going to be joining Leinster in a short-term contract in December until the end of next season. Pretty remarkable signing, you'd have to say, and fair play for Leinster for managing to keep this under wraps.
Is this
That's
the biggest
six
signing?
Months, is it?
Is it six? The short-term deal. We'll get the full details now on this breaking story. But I'm right in saying it's the biggest, if not one of the biggest signings. Biggest shock, anyway.
Yeah, you're signing a 27-year-old All Black who is in the absolute prime of his career. So it's a sabbatical. It sounds like it's going to be for 6 months. He will stay... New Zealand are touring, obviously, this part of the world in November. They're going to be playing Ireland in November, which adds a nice little subplot to that. So it sounds like he's going to stay in this part of the world rather than going back to New Zealand to join the Hurricanes for next year's Super Rugby. So, it's an amazing signing, you'd have to say. Even if it is only for 6 months, you never know what happens in those 6 months. Perhaps you'd like to say longer, you just don't know.
Yeah, you mentioned a short-term deal. So, in signing a new contract extension with the New Zealand Rugby Union, Barrett has exercised an option to play overseas, and he will join up with his new teammates in December of this year. Barrett has strong family connections with the province, and indeed with County Meath, where he spent some time in the early 2000s, where his family relocated to Oldcastle while his father Kevin managed a farm and played rugby with Buccaneers. This is coming from the Leinster press release, not off the top of my head.
Great knowledge, Shane.
So
he could line up for Meath Gaelic team while he's here as well, Shane.
They could do with him. Barrett, of course, has played over 100 Super Rugby games with the Hurricanes, will join Leinster Rugby in December and will stay until the end of the 2024-25 season. Leo Cullen has unsurprisingly welcomed the signing. We're delighted that Jordy has agreed to join us after New Zealand's tour in early December, especially as he's chosen Leinster ahead of a number of other very attractive options. Jordy's a 50 plus cap All Black with an outstanding skill set who's been performing at the highest level of the game for multiple seasons now. He's keen to seek out a new experience at Leinster. I'm sure we will learn a lot from each other during this time. That is
Keane. Like, it is incredible. But like, you look at the starting back line for Leinster. You have Gary Ringrose at 12, Robbie Henshaw at 13. Where are you putting Jordy Barrett?
Well, I suppose the beauty of Jordy Barrett, Ruby, is that he can play, you could put him in any position across the back line. Now, it's been interesting in the last sort of year to 18 months, and Irish supporters will definitely remember this, that how good he played at 12. The All Blacks have basically pushed him into 12 because his brother Bowden has been playing fullback. And obviously Irish fans will also remember in that World Cup quarter final, it was Jordy Barrett who got underneath Ronan Kelleher to hold him up over the line, which pretty much won the game for the All Blacks and cost Ireland a place in the semi-final. So I'm sure there'll be a bit of crack in the dressing room with Ronan Kelleher when he joins about that. But I could possibly see, like, the good thing about signing a player like this, Ruby, is that during the Six Nations, windows when the likes of Henshaw and Ringrose, Hugo Keenan are away. Jordy Barrett's going to be back and available for those couple of games that are on in the window. But you think of the Champions Cup first team, let's call it. I still think Robbie Henshaw and Gary Ringrose will be Leinster's first choice centre partnership, but I could definitely see Jordy Barrett playing on maybe the right wing, so you could have a back three of Hugo Keenan, Jordy Barrett and James Lowe, which would be harsh on someone like Jordan Armour, who's playing really well at the moment. But if you're signing Jordy Barrett for 6 months, you're going to want to get as much out of him as possible. And like I said, a 27-year-old in the prime of his career, it's unusual for an All Black to take a sabbatical in this part of the world, it has to be said. A lot of the All Blacks tend to go to Japan for a big payday. So perhaps there actually is, you know, he touched on it in the press release that Shane read out, they do have strong family connections to Meath, and what a place to spend 6 months surrounded by some of the best players in the world.
Well, obviously, look, the last weekend, Jamie Osborne faced off against Jonathan Dante of La Rochelle and put in an incredible performance. But I imagine if you're him, you're kind of thinking, oh, and then you're probably thinking, well, when everyone else is in the Irish camp, I'm going to get to play with him.
Possibly, but I think Jamie Osborne is very close to making that step up to the Irish squad, to be honest, Ruby. I'd be surprised if he doesn't tour South Africa in the summer. I think he's playing that well. I think the other key point to mention is that obviously Leinster have Charlie Nattoy on their books at the moment, who himself is a former All Black. But I think if Leinster are signing Jordy Barrett, that would probably suggest that Charlie Nattoy will probably leave at the end of the season, and he's been injured for the last few months. We haven't seen a whole pile of him, but Charlie Nattoy is definitely towards the latter part of his career, whereas Jordy Barrett, like I said, is literally in the prime. And this is, yeah, it's, I would say, one of the biggest signings in Irish rugby for quite some time.
So Orgie Snyman, possibly Taniela Tupu, the Tongan Thor, and now Jordy Barrett. Proper Galactical stuff.
Yeah, so like, I think Leinster have obviously fallen short. They've gone two seasons without winning a trophy. So like, you don't have a whole, I personally don't have a big problem with them being allowed to bolster their squad. But the irony is, having taken care of La Rochelle, and I know we're going to get into talk about that in a while, the kind of path is clear now for Leinster to become, you know, European champions again. And if they do finish the season finally getting that fifth star, and Orgie Snyman, like you said, Shane, is confirmed to be coming for next season, Jordy Barrett is going to be coming for the business end of the season, and they've been strongly linked to the Australian tight end Taniela Tupou. And I asked Leo Cullen about this a couple of weeks ago, and while he didn't confirm it, he certainly didn't deny it. So three of like the biggest signings you could possibly have. Tupou obviously still very much to be confirmed, but like, it's been an amazing few days for Leinster, having beaten La Rochelle. Dan Sheehan signed a new contract. He's been bumped up to a central IRFU deal as well today, so it's a good time to be a Leinster fan for sure.
There's a fair chance in 6 months Jordy Barrett could play more games for Leinster than Orgie Snyman played for Munster.
Well, just Munster's luck. You just know Orgie Snyman is going to go to Leinster and be unbelievable and get an injury-free run. But yeah, like I said, if Jordy Barrett's only going to be there for 6 months, he's going to play, I think, a hell of a lot of rugby. Leinster are going to want to get every last ounce of him out of him. And yeah, just I'm stunned really, because normally you kind of get wind of this and the rumours only crept in maybe an hour or two before Leinster decided to tease this. So I wonder if Andrew Goodman, who is a Kiwi himself, would have been involved in the Crusaders setup as opposed to the Hurricanes. He's going to be taking over obviously as Ireland's attack coach from Mike Hatt this summer, but I wonder if he had maybe connections to Jordy Barrett as well. So yeah, an amazing signing.
An amazing signing indeed. We will be diving into all of the rugby a little bit later on. Alan Collier is also here, and before we chat football, we're in the company of Ruby as well. Alan, I know on Friday you had Jane Mangan asking me horse racing tips. Who was I backing in the National? And I didn't go with Ian Maximus, to be fair, but Jane Mangan did say that Ian Maximus was like a Leicester City, either going to win you the Premier League title or get relegated. Well, he won. Wasn't the Premier League title, but it was the Grand National, storming clear of his rivals to give the all-conquering Willie Mullins a second victory in the Aintree showpiece. Successful, of course, with Hedgehunter 19 years ago. Mullins was responsible for 8 of the 32 headed to the post in Liverpool, but Ian Maximus was well touted to follow up last year's success in the Irish Grand National. Ruby, this is a brilliant achievement for Willie Mullins, and indeed for Paul Townend.
Oh, incredible stuff. Now, I had my doubts about him as well. I wasn't sure about him and his jumping, but look, Paul got him into a beautiful position every step of the way. Shane jumped, travelled, missed the chair, but that was his only real scare, and off from a long way out, he was the one you wanted to be on. But it was an incredible race when they fanned back across the Melling Road, sort of 20 horses with a chance, and you're looking at him thinking, wow, Rachel was travelling really well in Manila Indo, Delta Work, Gallia de Lito, Late Night Pass, and I am Maximus was tucked in behind him. It was a terrific race to watch. It was a brilliant result for the race and a great result for Paul and Willie. And look, we watched Paul give him a spectacular ride to win the Irish Grand National last year, and he gave Galloping the Champ a terrific ride to win last year's Gold Cup. And again, this year he's gone champion hurdle at Cheltenham, Gold Cup, English Grand National, and look, it's put Willie Mullins in an incredible position now as well, with a chance maybe of being champion trainer in the UK. But it was a brilliant day and a great race. And yeah, terrific for his owner as well, JP McManus. I mean, what a supporter of sport he is. And, you know, horse racing is nothing without sport, so it was a huge day for JP as well.
Speaking of supporters of sport, Alan Colley, Scheffler wins the Masters, I'm Maximus wins the National. You enjoyed your weekend of sport, I suspect.
It was nearly like sticking out like a sore thumb that the two of those would win, and I'd love to know how many people maybe backed that double. But just on entry, I thought it was brilliant, the whole festival, Ruby. There were some great winners and great rides throughout, but the one thing, and we discussed it here on Friday, that was absolutely brilliant and riveting TV, and I know you have a strong view on it too, and obviously listening to you doing the analysis, but the Stewards Inquiry with the three jockeys, Rachel Blackmore, Townend, and Harry Skelton, I thought was absolutely brilliant, and such an insight into, I suppose, just how they're feeling as well in terms of straight after a race.
Yeah, it was great TV, but I suppose maybe I'm a little bit in the know, but what did any one of the three of them tell you that you couldn't see?
I suppose from my point of view, and I loved the race, and what it told me was just how cutthroat it can be, because they're all in arguing their case that they want to win the race. So.
I know exactly. Well, that's what you'd expect. I mean, you're arguing against each other. But what piece of evidence did any one of the three of them give you that you couldn't see yourself on the television?
Well, I we could see exactly what they were all arguing, but I suppose just to hear it from the horse's mouth, pardon the pun, but
that's what you'd expect. I mean,
but I know your kind of add on to that is that then you want to see the next part of it.
Yeah, well, that was obviously, that happens in the UK where the Stewards Inquiries are televised if it's on terrestrial television. So obviously when that happened in the UK, they wanted to be reciprocated here. So at the time, I was on the Jockeys Association with plenty of my former colleagues who retired, and we said, yes, you can, as long as the cameras stay for the deliberation of the stewards. So if you're going to watch us give the evidence, we want to see the deliberation. And obviously that didn't suit, so...
Is that ever going to happen?
Why does that not suit Ruby?
They'll give you 100 different legal reasons, Alan. Codswallop, in my opinion. It should be. You watch it. I watch it, Keenan, you'll back me up here. I watch it day in, day out in rugby pitches. A referee has a chat with his two linesmen and a TMO. They decide, but they make the decision, they take the evidence, and they give you the result. And it's clear as water what's after happening.
We need more of it because it is a nice insight. Ruby, you mentioned and we discussed this on Friday as well, Willie Mullins now in the British trainer's title. So first prize in the National is £500,000, a sum which puts Mullins in contention for the title against Dan Skelton and Paul Nicholls. So I say in contention because it's far from a foregone conclusion.
Oh, it is, and that's the right way of putting it. I mean, leaving entry on Saturday and even yesterday, so Willie was £52,807 in front of Dan Skelton and £128,066 because it could come down to pounds, shillings and pence in front of Paul Nicholls. But there is only 2 weeks left in the season, but there's decent racing in Cheltenham on Wednesday and Thursday, and then in Ayr Friday and Saturday. Then there's a couple of low-key meetings Sunday, Monday, Tuesday where Willie may or may not have a runner, but where Paul and Dan could pick up. And even if you look at Willie's lead over Dan Skelton, like, Dan only has to win 10 small little races to wither that lead away. And in races that Willie wouldn't have horses qualified for, then you'll have 2 days in Perth, or 3 days in Perth even in Scotland, and the final day at Sandown. Now, there's some really big races, but Willie did come out of entry, it was 2016 or 2017, I'm not sure what year it was, a bit further ahead of Paul Nicholls. Paul Nicholls went up to Ayr and won the Scottish National the following week, and it all went down to the final day, and unfortunately Willie didn't come out on top. But look, he has a fighting chance, but he's still going to need another big pot or two in the UK if he's going to get over the line.
On that, Ruby, as well, and I know Willie Mullins, obviously, in terms of the dominance that he's having at the moment and the brilliance every season, and the pressure on to win Gold Cups and champion hurdles, and he's, it's almost a foregone conclusion that he might win the Irish Trainers' Championship. But at what point of the season, and I know obviously just after entry, does he ever have targets thinking to aim at the British Trainers' Championship, or is that something that just, as the season is progressing and here we are now a couple of weeks out and the position he finds himself in, that he'll go all out for it?
It's something that's progressed through the season. I mean, whatever way Willie looks at it at the start of the year, Alan, it's keep the home fires burning first. And you know, Gordon Elliott has a huge team of horses and puts up a fair challenge every year, so Willie has to mind his own patch first. And it became clear after the Dublin Racing Festival that he was going to be champion trainer here, and then with the Cheltenham he had, it gave him that opportunity. Now that was the same the last time too, and actually the last time it all came down to Vitor, Alan. Vitor fell in entry, and in a race he was going to, well, he was at halfway, but he was head and shoulders above the opposition. And that was the difference between winning and losing a Trainers' Championship back then. But when you're doing it the way Willie is doing it, the margins are fine because you're only playing selectively.
I think the emergence of Dan Skelton, sorry, just a quick last one on, yeah, on that, is absolutely brilliant as well, Ru, because obviously Paul Nicholls has been brilliant in England, but I think the emergence of him is brilliant also for the game.
Yeah, huge. But I mean, even when you look at it, so like Dan was Paul Nicholls' assistant trainer when I rode for Paul. And I can remember the first year Paul Nicholls was champion trainer and the competition he had to beat Martin Pipe and eventually getting there to beat Martin. Martin retired the day Paul Nicholls was champion trainer for the first time. Paul has won 14 since. He needs one more to better Martin Pipe. And this year, Willie Mullins is in his way. There's loads of slow plots and loads of stories
and
angles
narratives
in it. And like, just to watch what, I can imagine that the office in Ditchheath this morning, Clifford Baker, Paul's head man, and Paul, and they meticulously be going through every pound that can be won between now and Saturday week. Mm-hmm. And Dan Skelton will have seen that, and he'll be doing the same thing up there near Warwick, and I guarantee it's going to happen in Close Sutton as well.
The abacus is out. Keane Tracy has more news on Jordy Barrett. We will get to that. New Zealand Rugby have released a statement. However, there's news aplenty today. Tony O'Donoghue is on the line. So shock news that Jordy Barrett signs for Leinster. Not so much of a shock that Jonathan Hill departs the FAI, Tony.
I think it was probably since the Public Accounts Committee meeting in February, it was probably a question of, if not when, and maybe some people were expecting it after the announcement of the new manager, so that Jonathan Hill could sign off with the new Sky deal, the new manager, and a lot of things in the credit column for him, so to speak. But no, the news has emerged today that he's seeing out the rest of the month, I suppose. But effectively, by mutual consent, you might say, he's left the FAI after 3.5 years in charge. Now, as I understand it, his contract was up to 2027, so there may yet be details emerge of perhaps an exit package. He has left the building, so to speak. David Carell, the Castlebar County Mayo man, who came from the English FA as well, the same as Jonathan Hill, he's going to take over as interim CEO. He's currently the CEO, the Chief Operating Officer. And there's a lot of work to do. There always is with the FAI. And to Jonathan Hill's credit, you know, he took over at a very difficult time when there was governance issues, financial crisis. I mean, effectively, the FAI were bailed out by the government. And they had all of these governance concerns that they had to prove to government that they were worthy of funding. And most of them, to be fair, including gender balance recently, had been reached. But then the issue over Jonathan Hill's pay. Jonathan, you had one job, just try and keep everything totally, clean and clean as a whistle. The explanation was that it was more or less an accidental payment, that he didn't mean it, which didn't wash with the Public Accounts Committee people. And then that last appearance at the Public Accounts Committee, when the new president of the FAI, Paul Cook, couldn't bring himself to express full confidence in his CEO, even though the new independent chairman did at the time. Really, the die was cast at that stage. So yeah, it was only a question of when rather than if.
Tony, CEOs leave sporting organisations, leave big business, not all the time, but it's just it's part of business. But for people listening in, for Irish football fans, what does this actually mean? Is it damaging? Should we be concerned for Irish football that the CEO of the governing body has departed?
What we want from the FAI, what we need from the FAI, particularly in light of its recent history, and as I say, all those governance concerns, all those scandals, we wanted a CEO we never hear of, someone who we hope is efficient, good at his job, someone who gets a new manager appointed without a fuss, be that a men's or women's manager, someone who inspires confidence in the government, because the football pathways plan, it's a terrific document. Mark Hannam heavily involved in that, but you know, overseeing it all was the chief executive, and it's ambitious. It requires over the next 15 years, you know, something like over 800 million investment, and they're looking for the government to come up with almost half a billion, or maybe even a little bit more than half a billion of that. So you wanted, you know, the relationship between government to be restored. To a large extent, it has been, but you wanted there to be no issues. And I do feel the manager issue, you know, it may be the fact that, you know, they're cleverer than us and that they've gone through all the hoops, and that this week, as promised, we will get a new manager and we'll be delighted with it. But all the names that have been thrown into the hat and then have been taken out of the hat again, it's not really inspiring confidence. And there is a worry because we're lagging behind in a football sense. As much as it was great to see the women move up to League A, we're kind of out of our depth there, or out of our league, you might say. So Damien Duff is right. I mean, the investment needs to be in academies and facilities. And we need to be thinking not just the next CEO. They're talking about a structured search now before a permanent appointment will follow. We really need to be thinking longer term than will the next CEO manage to hang around longer than 3.5 years?
Well, that remains to be seen. Tony O'Donoghue, the search continues now for a CEO, an Irish men's national team manager. And I think there's an interim director of communications and marketing as well, just thrown in for good measure. Tony O'Donoghue, who's soccer correspondent with RTÉ. Thanks so much for taking the call there. We're going to take a very short break, but Alan Cawley is with us to continue our football chat. Plenty of twists and turns in a Premier League. Keane Tracy will continue the breaking news with Jordy Bard and Leinster rugby. And Peter Canavan will be chatting football. Stick with us here in Game On 2FM.
Game On
Football.
Now, you're very welcome back to a very busy Game On this evening with myself, Shane Dawson, alongside Ruby Walsh. Keane Tracy still with us, chatting rugby shortly. Peter Canavan is due up a little later on in Gaelic football. However, Alan Cawley, you are here to chat football and the twists and turns of the Premier League. We were all near agreement on Friday, weren't we? That would be, as you were,
yeah,
in the Premier League title race. However, Manchester City now hold a 2-point advantage over Arsenal and Liverpool, who are both on 71 points. Arsenal with an 8-goal greater goal difference over Liverpool as well. So what was your outstanding moment from the weekend Premier League title?
Yeah,
race?
It was an incredible day, really, Shane. There I was all afternoon building up towards the night in front of the golf and the Masters and all the drama that would ensue on that back nine, and it all happened between 1 o'clock and 5 o'clock.
Yeah.
And very little drama on the back nine for the Masters, so I got it all early on in the afternoon. And whatever about one of them losing, to have the two of them lose back to back in the manner that they did, it really surprised me. I didn't see it coming. As you said, we had the chat Friday night. We were thinking that definitely Liverpool would beat Crystal Palace, even though it was a tougher game for Arsenal because they were playing Aston Villa. I still thought the fact that they were at home and the brilliant run of form that they were on, that they would also get the victory. Man City were always going to beat Luton. So as you said, we thought it would be as you were, but the drama that unfolded was just incredible. And I suppose the manner in which they lost as well, when you think of Liverpool. And I wasn't all that surprised because Liverpool have fallen behind. I never thought Liverpool were going to win the league anyway. I thought they'd be right in the race right up until the end, but I didn't think they were going to win it. I had said Arsenal all along, and I thought it would come down to maybe Arsenal City, but right to the death. The fact that we're here, we are 6 games out now, and it almost feels as if it's done and dusted. It leaves me disappointed.
Is this the weekend that we'll look back and say that was a big one?
Oh, definitely, yeah, it was huge because You look at the fixtures that are to come and they're running, and you look at Man City 6, they've Brighton away, Forest away, Wolves at home, Fulham away, Spurs away, and West Ham. Like, it's very hard to see where they're going to draw points, Shane. And even if you look at Arsenal and Liverpool, you could argue that they have a harder running than City. Now, obviously, they'll have the distraction of the Champions League, Man City, because the second leg is coming up against Real Madrid. I think they'll go through that as well. So you're looking at another two legs, obviously, for a semi-final and potentially a final. So there might be distractions there, but it's very hard to see where they're going to draw points against any of those six that I've just named. So for me, and even looking at it, not so much the fact that they have the two-point advantage and are they going to draw points, psychologically the damage that made, especially Liverpool, they're gone because of the week they've had, but most of all Arsenal as well, I think psychologically the damage that would have done. And I was so disappointed because I think Arsenal have been so good, and they've been, the last 11 games they've won 10, drawn 1, so their form has been red hot, Shane. The first half yesterday was some of the best football I've seen them play all season. They were absolutely brilliant, but just the Achilles heel that they've had all season, they've no centre forward that's going to get you 20-25 goals at top marks, man. They've been chopping and changing with Havertz and Jesus, and the quality of the other players chipping in with goals, but ultimately it comes down to that marksman. Had they had the likes of an Ollie Watkins, who's after getting 19 for Villa playing for Arsenal, I think they would have went on to win the league.
And that was it, Alan. They got another fast start but just didn't get a goal, did they?
And that was the killer for them, because they were so dominant in some of the football, the standard of football between the two teams. I thought Villa as well was very, very good. It was a brilliant, technically brilliant match to watch. And the chances that they created, and the Trossard one is the killer, really, because in fairness, Martinez, I know people say it's a good save. I think Paul Merson summed it up brilliant on the telly. He says, I don't call that a good save, I call it a bad miss. And it was a bad miss, because where he put the ball, it was the only place that the keeper could save it. He had the whole goal to aim at, and yet he kicks it straight at the goalkeeper. There was something similar with Nunes as well, when he swiveled on a volley, and again he should have scored 6 yards out for Liverpool and hits it straight at Dean Henderson. Now it's a brilliant reaction save, but it just hits straight at him. So they've only themselves to blame, Ruby. But I think another point as well, it's hard to criticise Arsenal and Liverpool to an extent, because how many years gone by have we seen title races where you can actually afford to maybe draw a game or drop the odd couple of points? The standard of Man City is so good that they just don't even allow you. When you think Arsenal are on a run of 10 wins and one draw, and they lose one match yesterday, and it almost feels like it's over, as we said. So that just tells you the standard of Man City and how good they are, and how much the bar has been raised in recent seasons with them. And I actually feel for them, because I think Arsenal have been so, so good, but ultimately the second half absolutely killed them yesterday.
When you look around the Premier League, Alan, there was other stories as well, and Spurs took some trimming at Newcastle, didn't they?
Yeah, absolutely hammered. Good result for Newcastle, probably needed as well from Eddie Howe's point of view, just in terms of maybe his long-term future. But Spurs, they did, and when you think of, obviously, they're in that race as well, and they were in prime position going into the games at the weekend. They were playing a 12:30 on Saturday. Could have gained another advantage over Villa, who you would have thought maybe lost against Arsenal, and the complete opposite happened. So questions to answer maybe for Postecoglou just on that performance. But yet I think still he's only very much in his infancy, as we said all season, Ruby. To get into the top four would have been a hell of an achievement for them. Still alive, they still have a chance, but I think they need a big reaction from that performance. Most of all, obviously the result looks bad, it was the performance that was probably the most surprising.
Erik ten Hag tried to spin it positively, I think, in post-match, and but the journey Manchester United are on, but at the end of the day it was 2-2. They nearly conceded a penalty overturned by VAR right at the end as well, so could have easily lost 3-2. We walked out of the press conference when a question was posed about possibly Manchester United finishing the lowest ever Premier League spot as well. He's a man feeling the, not under the pressure, but feeling the pressure now.
He's feeling the heat, Shane. He absolutely is feeling the heat. And I thought, I was actually disappointed with his comments in the aftermath, not so much the walking out of the press conference. I saw that bit as well, where there were the journalist asked him about the lowest finish potentially, but it is potentially. What disappointed me was the comments about, he basically threw Garnacho under the bus. And now, I don't know, has something gone on at half time amongst them, and obviously he was aggrieved or annoyed with that, but Garnacho did make the mistake for the first goal. But Garnacho has probably been the shining light all season, and one lad who nobody questions his attitude and his work rate, and he runs around and he tries, and he's only a kid. And if you're pinning all that pressure on a young kid, it tells you where Man United are at the moment. But I thought his comments were really disappointing. He obviously took Garnacho off at half time as well, but he could have taken any of them off. They were an absolute shambles against Shane, and I don't know how many times we've said this all season. Bournemouth totally outplayed them. The fact that they got away with a 2-2 draw, I can't believe it. He should have been absolutely over the moon with that, Ten Hag. But it just tells you where they're at when they're going to the likes of Bournemouth, and nobody's even surprised that they're getting outplayed by Bournemouth. They were fantastic, Bournemouth. And I think he'd be gone. I can't see Ten Hag being there next year. It's just a mess. And ultimately, the buck stops with him. He's the manager. They have the stats about the amount of shots faced as well. Like, it's the amount of shots faced is there with Sheffield United and Luton, the teams that are at the bottom of the table. It's horrendous stats, and so damaging for him as the manager that these issues aren't being addressed. And every week we watch them, they're so easy to get at. Teams outplaying them, shots on goal. It's just an absolute mess, and the season can't end quick enough for Man United.
Elsewhere, no Evan Ferguson for Brighton, but great to see Marco Mahoney get on for a Premier League debut for Brighton as well. Chelsea Everton is the Monday night football in the Premier League. Just before we do take a break, Alan Colley, Dundalk Bows in Oriel. Dundalk bottom of the table. Bows had a win on Friday. Can Dundalk get their first victory of the season this evening?
No. I think,
or will Bows continue their good run of
form? I think Bows have to back up that. Obviously, the performance I don't think wasn't great, but the result was huge for them on Friday night. You'll be disappointed from a Shelburne point of view, but it's a huge result for Alan Reynolds, and obviously he's only starting off his managerial reign at Bohemians. So I think he needs to back up that, not just, I suppose, the result and the performance, but you need to back it up against the bottom team, as you said. Dundalk haven't won all season, so home win for Bohemians.
So much for this crisis, I suppose. They win this evening and they go 16 points level with Derry City in second. So it's all happening in football. Alan Colley, thank you very much for popping in. Keane Tracy is with us next on Rugby. Stay with us here in Game On.
Game On.
Rugby.
So, Ruby, Jordy Barrett joins Leinster. Before we chat to Keane Tracy, let's hear from Jordy Barrett.
I've always admired Leinster as a club, Ireland as a country, and when I had the opportunity to join them, it was a no-brainer for me. I have a family connection there where I lived in Ireland with the rest of my family for a couple of years as a 4 or 5 year old, and it's a place that's pretty special to me. So to have the opportunity to go back and meet some family and friends again and connections that were made up to 20 years ago is pretty cool. Yeah, mum and dad made a decision when there was 6 kids, not 8, there was 2 that followed. So they made a decision to leave New Zealand for a change of lifestyle. Went over, dad played second division for the Buccaneers, and just a change of scene, living and working on a dairy farm in County Meath, and got so many connections there. Yeah, the forefront of my decision to go to Europe, particularly go to Leinster, is I'll be 28 years old, and at that stage I feel like I should be playing some of my best rugby, and I feel like it's an opportunity to grow my game and hopefully take myself to a different level. And it's a club with a proud history, a very successful history, well coached, a lot of international players in that squad, so I'm very much looking forward to going there and developing my game.
Developing his game. I'm not sure how much better his game can get, Keane Tracy.
Yeah, it's going to be a mutual one, though. I mean, he does get to, like I said earlier, Ruby, he does get to work with the bones of the Irish team. And look, I know there's going to be a lot of people up in arms, particularly from Munster, Connacht and Ulster, that, you know, the rich get richer and all of that. But it is a 6-month short-term contract. And shortly after we were talking earlier, Ruby, the New Zealand Rugby Union released a press release of their own. I suppose it was to soften the news that one of their players is moving to Ireland. But basically, Jordy Barrett has signed a new contract with the New Zealand Union till 2028. So that means he'll obviously be going back ahead of the 2027 World Cup. So that would pretty much rule out the possibility of Jordy Barrett, you would imagine, staying beyond the 6 months. So it is a short enough period of time, but like I had mentioned earlier, he's coming for the business end of the season. It couldn't be better timed, really.
He couldn't. New Zealand are sending a spy up to see what we're at. But anyway, Keane Tracy, let's rock on. And he's getting paid for it. He's getting paid for the privilege. Oh my God, what a clever man. Leinster La Rochelle, 40-13 was the final score, but Leinster definitely put the ghost to bed.
They absolutely did, Ruby, and what a way to put the ghost to bed. I'll be honest, I did not see, well look, I don't think anyone saw a scoreline like that coming. Leinster were absolutely awesome. They went to a level that they simply haven't got to this season. They haven't had to get to this season either. I know they beat La Rochelle over in France in the pool stages, but that obviously wasn't a do or die knockout game. And look, they still have two more games to get through. They're going to play Northampton in the semi-final, and you would imagine Toulouse will get to the final on the other side of the draw. So they're not there yet, but having gotten rid of their nemesis La Rochelle, if Leinster were to go on and finally get that fifth star on their jersey, it would be all the sweeter because they managed to beat La Rochelle in the build-up. I'd say it was the day, Ruby, that we saw Jack Nienaber's defence really come to the fore. Shortly after he arrived, he told us in a press conference on a Monday afternoon that it was going to take 14 weeks for the Leinster players to rewire their brains, was the phrase he used.
And yeah, I remember it.
Yeah, I think we saw at the weekend that the brains have been well and truly rewired. Their defence was absolutely awesome. For the second time in three games, Leinster kept top quality opposition scoreless for the second half. So if you think back to a couple of weeks ago at the RDS, they beat a really strong Bulls team by scoring 35 unanswered points. At the weekend, they managed to score 17 points without reply against La Rochelle, obviously keeping them scoreless for the second half, which was a massive mental hurdle to overcome, because Leinster went 17 points ahead and then La Rochelle score a try just before half time, and all of a sudden you were getting a sense of deja vu, because this is exactly what happened at the same place in last year's final. And this is something Leo Cullen was touching on afterwards. So whatever was said in the dressing room at halftime had the desired effect, because Leinster came out and rather than go into their shells, which they possibly did 12 months ago, they actually stepped it up another gear. And that Ryan Baird try, which was a sensational team try, we obviously didn't get a chance to have our moments of the weekend with the breaking news earlier, but that to me was just an absolutely brilliant try, and it showed a mental resolve that we haven't seen, I think, from Leinster over the last couple of years, and that's really going to stand to them going forward.
It was an incredible team try, but it was a magnificent individual finish.
Yeah, look, Ryan Baird is just going from strength to strength, and it was a huge day for him, Ruby, because you look at I know La Rochelle were missing a couple of players, particularly from their front row, but you look at the players that Leinster were missing, and in particular James Ryan, obviously Gary Ringrose as well. They're the co-captains of the team for a reason.
Hugo Keenan
on the morning of the game pulled out as well. They are three players who would walk into most teams in the world, and with James Ryan out of the picture and Leinster opting for Jason Jenkins ahead of Ross Maloney, it meant that Ryan Baird had to call the line out. And like, for anyone who doesn't know, like, calling the line out against a line out as good as La Rochelle's under the pressure is not easy, and Ryan Baird doesn't do that a whole pile. It's something he started learning over the last year, I would say. But if James Ryan is playing, he does that. Tadhg Byrne does it for Munster. It's a massively important role, and the fact that Ryan Baird did that at the weekend and it didn't impact his performance around the pitch, like you touched on, Ruby, the finish for his try was sensational. That was a big statement, I think, for Ryan Baird. It's going to be a big summer for him, you'd imagine, going down to South Africa, because he has his eyes on that number 6 jersey for Ireland as well. So it was just like, it was a 23 man effort. I thought Will Connors, it's definitely worth mentioning. He was the epitome of a horses for courses selection. I was writing about this in today's Irish Independent, that to me, look, Will Connors hadn't played in the Champions Cup since he played in the pool game. It's a really strange scenario, because I was thinking, after he played so well back in December in the horrible weather, I was thinking, wow, we're going to see the rebirth of Will Connors. He's had a really tough time with injury. Andy Farrell is a big fan. I was thinking, God, he's going to probably make the Six Nations squad, and we just haven't really seen him. He's played in a few URC games but hasn't been in the Leinster squads for the big games, and to me that was a Jack Nienaber selection. And I know Leo Cullen, the buck stops with him, he has the final decision ultimately, but it was a real horses for courses selection. Will Connors, Leo Cullen described him on the eve of the game as the best chop tackler in the game. The guy is doing a PhD at the moment on tackling in rugby. You couldn't have a better guy in terms of...
Yeah.
He's doing a PhD at the moment on tackling in rugby in a bid to
make the game... He's not fanatical.
Yeah, in a bid to make the game safer. So I mean, the guy is, there's very few people who can do what he does, because he is not a small man, and his ability to get low to the ground and chop the likes of Will Skelton, Uni Antonio, was outstanding. Interestingly, in both games, he only played 49 minutes and he made 7 and 8 tackles. It wouldn't be unheard of if we don't see Will Connors play in the Champions Cup for the remainder of it, because you have a former World Player of the Year, Josh van der Vlier. And like I said, he was a real horses for courses selection. But what a performance. Like, away from the tackling, he was key to disrupting La Rochelle's breakdown, which was so important to Leinster winning the game. So that fed into, I think, the overall defensive display. Look, they scored 5 tries. The quality of their tries was exceptional. Ross Byrne probably had his best game and answered a lot of critics. He needs now, that needs to be the standard for Ross Byrne going forward. But to me, the victory was built on the foundations of an unbelievable defence that was inspired by Jack Nienaber.
And it was huge for Ross Byrne. I mean, you look back at the Six Nations, Johnny moves aside, the World Cup. He didn't get the nod there. It was a huge day for him.
Yeah, look, he's had a tough time with injury this season as well. He tore his bicep back in, I think it was December, missed out on the Six Nations. He's had to watch his brother go back ahead of him in the pecking order with Ireland. And there was a bit of talk going into the game, you know, who is Leinster's first choice 10, because Harry Byrne had been playing ahead of him. You obviously have Kieran Frawley there, but Leinster just seemed to prefer Kieran Frawley as a fullback, and he did really well at the weekend. But what I liked, Ruby, about Ross Byrne's performance was he kicked unbelievably well, and everyone knows that he is a great kicker and he kicks really well under pressure, and he did that again at the weekend. But it was the other parts of Ross Byrne's game that I think everyone has wanted to see more of. It's taking the ball to the line, taking it flat, and he did that on so many occasions. Copped a lot of big hits for his trouble. Yeah. Very similar to how Johnny Sexton used to play. So to me, it was, like I said, it was a bit of a statement performance from Ross Byrne, but this needs to be the standard for him. He was so important in a couple of those tries that we're talking about. It's his lovely hands in open play that releases the ball out wide. And I think he set a new standard for himself. And if he can kick on and play like that for the rest of the season, then Leinster are going to have a massive chance of going all the way in this year's Champions Cup.
Well, they'll have to get over Northampton first in Croker.
Yes.
Well, on the first weekend in May, the May Bank holiday as well. Toulouse play Harlequins in the other quarter, or the other semi final, I should say. Disappointingly, Connacht and Ulster were defeated in the Challenge Cup. However, Keane, we must finish up our rugby chat by mentioning Ireland's brilliant win over Wales in Cork in the Women's Six Nations Championship. Moves Ireland up to third place. Now, they do have the daunting task of England in Twickenham. But this victory has been a long time coming, Keane, and it is great to see this Irish team get over the line and get a win in the Six Nations.
Absolutely, Shane. Like, look, Leinster are obviously going to get most of the headlines from the weekend, but this was a massively important win for the Ireland women's team. It was just a pity that it clashed, really, because it deserved to get a lot more coverage. Their first Six Nations win since April 2022. They didn't get a single point in last year's tournament, and obviously they have a new coach. Scott Beamond has come in, a lot of young players, and you could definitely see over the first couple of games, you know, signs of improvement, but it was all about trying to get that monkey off their back in terms of getting the win on the board. And there's actually a lot of parallels, I would say, to Leinster hammering La Rochelle in the manner that they did, because Ireland didn't just scrape to a win, Shane, at the weekend in Musgrave Park. They absolutely pumped Wales and they scored some brilliant tries themselves. They've really unearthed, I think, a couple of gems. Aoife Wafer has been outstanding. Her ball carrying ability to get over the gain line is a massive part of why Ireland are doing so well. When you've an out half who can kick as well as Dan O'Brien, you've got Katie Corrigan scoring her first Six Nations, her first international try actually, and then Baveen Parsons, who, look, has been the poster girl for Irish rugby over the last couple of years. It's all coming together nicely. It's just a pity that they're going to Twickenham this weekend, because look, that is what it is. England are on a different level at the moment, but they're going to have Scotland in the last game, and that's going to give them another massive opportunity to get a second win on the board.
Well, the wheel had to turn somewhere, and thankfully it did turn last weekend for the women's Irish rugby team. Keane Tracy, thanks a million for taking our call, for coming into studio, even as twice I nearly did that to you. I'm so used to saying taking our call. We'll be back after this break with Peter Canavan.
Game on.
Gaelic football.
Welcome back to Game On, where we are going to talk Gaelic football, and I'm delighted to say that Peter Canavan joins us on the line. Peter, Leinster, Ulster Football Championships, it's kind of hard to know where to start, because the two you thought would win did win, Armagh and Dublin, and outside of that, there was entertainment outside of that, wasn't there?
there was a bit of entertainment, Ruby. Not a wild pile, to be honest, with what, six games. And I know the two Ulster games were very disappointing in terms of spectacles for different reasons. Armagh game, you could argue, was over after 20 minutes. They were very dominant. And the Down and Antrim game was just... It was a horrible game to watch, and it was slow, laboured, both teams getting a lot of men behind the ball and very little action of note. The biggest talking points probably before the game started in the parade and at half time on the way in, so that would tell you enough about that game.
We won't go any further with that one, so I'm moving swiftly away from it.
We're not, and Leinster, I thought the Kildare and Wicklow game was very exciting, and Wicklow came within a kick of the ball from putting Kildare out and what would have been a dramatic finish. I think it was young Matt Doan, their wing back, had a brilliant chance to put them out of the competition, and it just went narrowly wide, and fair play to Kildare, they came back and they managed to get the winner. But apart from that, I suppose the other games, Louth won with 7 to spare, Offaly at 8 to spare, and Dublin 16. So once again, I suppose the Leinster championship's coming in for a bit of flack.
It's coming in for a bit of flack, but is there any positivity to be taken in terms of, okay, Dublin Meath, the attendance was shocking, it was far from a proper Dublin Meath rivalry, it was a foregone conclusion in terms of the result. We didn't learn much from Dublin. A couple of misplaced kickouts in the first half from Stephen Cluckson. I'm sure that will be resolved by the time Offaly come around. But for Offaly, first win over Laois in 2002. You mentioned absolute chaos, the carnage in the last minute of the Kildare-Wicklow match. And there was some great goals in Louth. Okay, they did defeat Wexford by a sizable margin as well. But Sammy Mulroy, brilliant performance, similar to Park Faulkner last week for Cavan as well. There are positives to be taken from the provincials, or am I just being too optimistic here?
If you take Dublin out of it, yes, it would be a great championship. But it's just got the feeling from day dot that you're playing to be a runner up, and it's nearly a case of God help the teams now that end up playing against Dublin. You know, such as the dominant force that they are. So look, I don't think it reflects well. You know, Dublin aren't happy about this either. You know, that's 20 of the last 25 provincials that they have won. In terms of prep for, you know, their bigger games ahead, is the like of yesterday any good for them? Probably not. So, you know, I think everybody at this stage accepts that the system is not the best for the GAA moving forward, and we've got to change things about. Look, other counties are doing their best. They're you know, trying to get up the rankings, of course. But what I'm saying is the system that we have does nothing for them. It's clearly not working or not helping them to get to the level that they need to go to. So it's and look, it's not just Leinster. Ulster, which was very dominant and when it comes to being ultra competitive, we've had a lot of poor games in Ulster this past 4 or 5 years too. And you know, that's coming from me, who the medals, provincial medals that I have mean a lot to me. But I think we've got to realise that we've got a system that we're hanging on to, and it's not producing the best affair for players or for supporters moving forward.
If you were to make a couple of simple changes, and we haven't got much time, what would Peter Canavan do?
I think it's time to change the order of our major competitions, Ruby. You have Championship, League and Provincial Championships. So why not try and start with the Provincial Championships first, and use that as your precursor for the League. And the League is really competitive, really good games. And if we could play that later on in the year, I think you'll have big crowds at it. Every game should be competitive. And that takes you right into the group stages, and by then you'll know exactly what you have to do in order to make, you know, the race for the Sam Maguire. So even that tweak in itself, I think moving forward, it would certainly be worth looking at.
Sounds pretty logistic. Prince City, obvious to me, provincial into league, into championship, and then keep the Tailteann. Division 1, Division 2, yeah. Championship, Division 3, Division 4, and Tailteann Cup.
That's right. And if you look at the league games, teams are playing against teams of similar, you know, standard. So that means it's competitive. When you, as soon as the leagues are over, for a lot of counties, they're saying, right, that's us. You know, we can't, there's nothing else. Well, there's a competition for us to win, but it's very highly unlikely that we're going to do it. Whereas moving in, into the league, I think you're going to get better quality fare at a better time of the year. And I'm just thinking of even, you know, supporters from this county, Throne, going down to Mayo, going down to Killarney in April or May to play a meaningful league game. It would enhance the game, it would enhance the crowds, and better for every county, not just the top counties moving forward.
That sounds very logical to me. Peter Canavan, thanks very much for taking our call this evening. Shane, that is about all we have time for.
It is indeed. You will be back with Marie tomorrow. I'll be back Wednesday. Bette de Silva is up next on 2FM. A big thanks to Ronan Lawler, I should say. Get our producer's name right or I'll get the boo. And Laura Lee Davis for working on this evening's show. From myself, Ruby, and all of the Game On team, it is bye for now.